We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind today, and I am on with Kim. How are you, Kim?
Great, thanks. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing really great. This was an episode I'm not sure why I chose this episode, but I think I chose a good batch of stories to talk about today.
Oh my God. I went through every kind of emotion watching this episode. Whew.
This was a good example of a solid Unsolved Mysteries episode. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
All the emotions are here. There's kidnapping, there's arson, there's
bank robbery.
Hostage situations and even photographs being taken by strangers while on a high-speed chase. It's very exciting. So the getaway photo.
Real quick, sorry, we're talking about season 4, episode 19.
That's right, from February 26, 1992.
Yes.
This brings us originally to a bank robbery. Now, Robert Stack mentions that currently, there are 40 banks robbed every day in the United States.
That's crazy.
Right? It seems excessive, although, just in my area alone, I think there were 3 bank robberies in the past year. But that's a year, not a day.
Yeah.
But you did a little bit of research.
A day is
on
crazy.
This, and you found that number is still pretty high.
Yeah, because I kind of called BS on that because I was like, really, 40 a day? But yeah, in 2017, 11 banks per day were robbed at gunpoint.
And I looked up how much cash is on hand in your average bank, and it's basically between $50,000 and $200,000. So is it worth it? I don't know. I guess...
I'll tell you this. We are so going to get arrested.
I know. When I was doing the search for that, I'm like, how much money is in a bank normally?
Oh my God. As we're researching, like, most famous bank robbers, how'd they get away with it? Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, when I first bought this house, we needed like $15,000 for something. I forget what it was, but it had to do with, it had to be in a separate account. So it was good. Mm-hmm. They were like, well, it's going to cost $100 for us to write the check. I'm like, I'm not paying $100 to take my money. So I'm like, give it to me in cash. And they wouldn't do it. And it took 2 days. I had to fill out a form, and I said, I will not spend $100 for you to give me access to my money.
Yeah, that's
and
crazy.
So I waited 2 days. So, nice. And I'm like, I'll take it in fives. Make me feel super rich for a day. So, but yeah, 11 banks robbed per day, and that does seem pretty high.
Yeah, but this one in particular, we're profiling two pretty prolific bank robbers. They were known colloquially, I guess, as the Trenchcoat Robbers. They are estimated to have robbed 28 banks between 1987 and 1997, this little duo here. So it's an hour before opening, Henderson, Nevada, we're in 1991, and a bank is robbed at gunpoint. They come in with these, like, clear face
masks. Yeah, I'm not sure what they were, but they were good. Like, you would not be able to discern what these people look like.
Yeah, and we'll post pictures of it on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast on Facebook, of course, of the pictures of the actual robbery and stuff. But the manager, they come and they take the manager. The manager's like, look, I only have half the code. I can't do anything until other people get there. So they just all wait. More people start showing up, and it's really smart. One of these guys the whole time actually has like a police scanner earpiece so he can hear if an alarm has been
triggered. It seems as though on paper they were really kind of doing something. At least they had a plan. Now, where you live, can you listen to police scanners?
I think so.
They're digital here. So you used to be able to listen to Nassau County's, but no longer. Although, when all of these, you know, protests and riots and everything have been going on, I downloaded an app. I forget what it's like, 911 something. And you can listen to police scanners from all around the country. And it's, I mean, it's a little addictive, but it's also a little bit, a little too nerdy for me. So I had to delete that app.
Oh, well, I'm going to be downloading that right now.
I'm just kidding. But I still have the, but I'm trying to look cool in front of you, Kim. Come on.
Sorry. Well, the bank employees, they do come in and they're just like slowly taken hostage one by one. And they actually come on Unsolved Mysteries. And because these bank robbers are still out there, they are just filmed in like silhouette. We don't get their names. We don't see their faces.
In the reenactment and in this, it has to be traumatizing to go through any type of robbery. But a bank robbery just seems... you're kind of stuck in a bank. And you think of a bank, it's kind of a secure, safe place, I think.
Yeah, but this one poor girl, I mean, I felt the worst for her. But basically, they open the vault for the robbers and everybody goes inside. And at this point, we have like four people held hostage. So at some point, we don't know when, a silent alarm is activated. And so police kind of hang out in the parking lot and they're just staking out the bank. Yeah. So we get to talk to like Sergeant Richard Perkins from the Henderson Police Department, who tells us that once police are there, a police dispatcher actually placed a call to the bank to see like, oh, hey, are you being robbed? It was so weird. And the guy to me was like too subtle about saying he was being robbed. Like he was like, he's like, normally I was really cheery, but this time I was just cheery. Like I took it down from a 10 to a 7. And when she asked if I was doing okay, I said yes. Like he was just, he was acting like she knew his every move. And this
now, if nobody's listening to me, right? Like, and I'm like, I have to answer the phone and nobody's on the other, you know, extension or something. I would just say, no, this is not the pizzeria, you know, and just hang up.
Exactly.
And they'd be like, all right, something's up, or did I dial wrong, you know?
I would be like 17. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Oh, tell Marjorie about that jam was delicious. Right, or like something to just raise their suspicions, but not just answer her questions. So the bank robber's like, who was that? And he was like, it was the guy across the street because they're in this little shopping plaza. Very smart. And he goes, the guy across the street thinks something's up. So if I don't go out and tell him like we're good in here, then he is going to call the cops and we don't want the cops to be called. So the bank robber's like, all right, you go out and you talk to the guy. So the guy goes out and he talks to the police and tells them that they are being robbed because the police are out in the parking lot.
Do you think that they expected him to come back?
I don't know. The guy said,
he's like, I'm free.
If I was the employees, I'd be pissed that the captain didn't go with the ship. Yeah.
See, why not me? I'll go.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be tripping him on his way out. I mean, you're the boss. Like, you should stay there. I'm making like $7 an hour. Let me go. But basically, the robbers are like, we got to get out of here. So they grab a hostage. And one of these dumb robbers takes his mask off before they leave.
I don't know what that was about. Although I do think it's weird to walk out of a bank wearing masks at all. That might, you know, you never know who's driving by if they think that police aren't even out there. And there are, at least in the reenactment, I think two police officers.
Yeah, there's two police cars. So then we give chase. And you can tell this is where, like, all the money for the budget went this episode. The squealing tires. The robbers get into the car with our little hostage gal. And they are zigzagging. They go through this, like, super complex apartment complex where there's all these dead ends. But they knew exactly which way to go. So they end up losing the cops. And they get their hostage and they hop into another car.
I mean, they had a plan on some level.
These guys were prolific.
And the hostage is keeping her eyes closed.
So that is smart. Like the best thing. Such good thinking.
I would find it difficult to do that because I'm such a busybody. Yeah. I would have to peek a little bit, maybe go, where am I? Near the Taco Bell.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's just not something I would be thinking of in that moment. But she's like squeezing her little eyes shut. And she just said to the camera, like, I wanted them to know that I could not identify them so that they wouldn't.
She's in survival mode and good for her because who knows what these people are capable of. Although they do seem kind of, let's say, 70% professional They're there for one reason, to not hurt anyone and to just walk away with however much money is in this bank.
From what I can tell by reading up on the rest of their bank robberies, it was very out of character for them to grab a hostage. Like, I'm assuming because the cops were called, they were just kind of using her as like a human shield. But thankfully, they do let her out. She escapes. She's unharmed. So thank goodness. But the chase is still on. So speaking of little busybodies, we get newspaper reporter and police scanner aficionado Catherine Scott, who is listening to her police scanner and she hears it. So she grabs her purse and she is like hustling to her car with her police scanner in one hand and her like 1991 camera in the other.
I love it because she's so dramatic about it too. She should have a podcast.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, she died of breast cancer in 2000.
Less competition, Kim. But, come on.
Oh, my God. Well, she was doing her thing. She was like, I am getting that promotion. So she knew where the car was getting close to her. So she goes, she's in the opposite lane, and she sees the car coming up. She's like, this has to be it. So she, like, super subtly, like when you're trying to take a picture of somebody
it.
In public.
I loved it so much.
Yeah. They're going in like opposite lanes, so she like sticks her hand up and was like,
"How much did you love this moment?"
Right as they went by, oh my god, it made me laugh so hard.
In the picture, I know you were like, "Well, I thought you weren't too impressed with the photo, I think," but I was. I thought it was good.
I wasn't expecting much, and it met my expectations. Is all I'm saying. Like they were going at a high speed chase in opposite directions in 1991. She snapped this photo. It was fun.
I do want to mention that Henderson, Nevada. Is not some little hick town. No offense to the Hicks. There are 288 homes over the price of $1 million for sale right now. We have $13 million houses with Lamborghinis in the front. We have mansions. So this is a very, very eclectic area. There are little spots. So I can imagine maybe the bank did have a pretty high volume of cash on hand.
You know, I read the number. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I can tell you guys it was five figures. Like, it was not that much. But I did learn a lot about these guys. So we kind of end Unsolved Mysteries saying, like, here's the description based off the picture that busybody news reporter Catherine Scott took. And, you know, he's 5'9", approximately 175 pounds, et cetera, et cetera. So a big juicy mustache. But we learn that after 7 years after the story aired, William Kirkpatrick, who was arrested for a routine traffic stop, and he was carrying $1.8 million in cash in his car.
Imagine just even having half that on hand or a tenth.
You know, it's crazy. I read they did one where they robbed one bank where they robbed $4.4 million and they described it as 330 pounds of cash.
I'll take 1 pound. How about that?
Oh my God. Holy it's crazy. Moly. But so, you know, I mean, look, here's the thing. How many of these stories get caught because they like run through a red light or like are speeding? Like, always drive like you got a body in the car, people.
Now, we have
so
another
crazy.
Story coming up later. Where we talk about having so much cash on hand and it really kind of being a part of your demise. So maybe just don't have this. I mean, all right, he stole the money. What the hell's he going to do with it? But if you're going to steal this kind of money, leave. Like, I don't know. Get out of the country. I mean, this is 1990. When was it that?
97.
It was still easy to get out of the country. You know, I remember flying to L.A. in 1999, and I left my driver's license at home, and they still let me on the plane.
Well, you know, these guys had it down pat, and once you get it down pat, you kind of start getting a little floppy after, like, 10 years and 28 bank robberies.
Meth.
So we... allegedly. But the second robber was identified as Ray Bowman, who died behind bars in 2011. Now, let me tell you what led up to their demise, because this just is funny to me. So Kirkpatrick, the guy who we get the mugshot of on Unsolved Mysteries, he and his girlfriend just started getting super sloppy in 1997. He had these storage units, and then he just stopped paying them one day. So as storage unit owners do, the guy was like, I'm going to go in there and auction this
stuff
off.
We've all seen it on YouTube, and I think there's TV shows where they do this.
Exactly. So he goes in, and he finds gun silencer parts, bulletproof vests, a baseball bat with the word police on it, or baseball cap, sorry, a police scanner with the earpiece attached, books on disguises, and videos about how to pick locks. So the storage unit guy was like, I'm kind of in over my head. So he contacts the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So it's also around this time that his girlfriend, and I'm picturing her like Gumad, you know, like super like Jay-Z, like, I don't know why, but I'm just,
can I just say, if you throw in our internet histories, we might be in a lot of trouble here. Like, if you threw that on top of this, you might be just saying guilty.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I know. Honestly, we better really toe the line. But the girlfriend pays $180,000 in cash to a contractor to build her this
lock. That's a nice amount of money in that time, too.
Yeah, and the contractor's like, you guys don't have jobs. Like, where does this money come from? So he actually reported it to the IRS.
She needed a shadier contractor, in my opinion.
Honestly. I mean, we got the one, honestly. Yeah, yeah. Sorry to our contractor fans. But the IRS serve a federal grand subpoena on the girlfriend. So Kirkpatrick gets spooked, leaves her, is like, peacing out of town. And he drops off $500,000 at his estranged brother's house in two briefcases. And he's like, if anything happens to me, I want you to give one of these suitcases each to
it's
my
like Breaking
daughters.
Bad or something, all of a sudden, with all the cash that they have on hand.
Yeah, and then this douchebag brother opens it up, sees the money, and is like, nope. And he calls the FBI. So now we have the FBI, the IRS, and the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms all involved looking for these people. So Kirkpatrick, when he gets arrested, his dumb girlfriend goes to bail him out with $100,000 cash. Yeah, oh, just show up with another briefcase, $100,000. So they're like, okay.
Crazy.
Yeah. So they arrest her on money laundering because this is the same money from the banks. It's the same serial numbers from the banks.
I mean, go to a bond bell. What are they called? Honestly, bond bellmen or something? They're usually across the street from these places. And you know what? Give them the money because they could probably launder it for you.
Yeah, and we know they don't care. So they serve a warrant on Kirkpatrick's house and they're searching through everything and they find pictures of kids on his refrigerator. And they're like, I wonder whose kids they are. So they do some research and they find out that these kids are William
Merry
Bowman.
Christmas card.
So I know. So they serve a warrant on William Bowman and you guys, they find everything robbery like related except for bags with like dollar signs on it in his house. They find like makeup, wigs, beards.
Now, this is not information that we learn from Unsolved Mysteries. I do want to just point that out. This is stuff that you dug up.
No, this is all from the trial, from the court transcripts. So a bulletproof vest, lock picking manuals. They also found a key making machine, lock picking equipment, and 112 guns. So they arrest him, and in 98, they're both charged for six of the robberies in six different states that happened from 87 to 97. So even though they're suspected of 28, they're only in trouble for six. So their last robbery in 1997 is the one that netted $4.4 million that we talked about. And Bowman was sentenced to 24 and a half years. He died in prison in 2011. Kirkpatrick is out now after serving 15 years.
You know, I did make the comment partially as a joke, but also kind of serious. The contractor that turned them in, I wonder if he needed to return the $180,000.
I'm sure. I don't think you get to keep it. And he didn't even do the work. So I'm sure he probably had to give it over to the IRS.
Probably $360,000.
One for you, one
for
me.
Shadier contractor than we gave credit for.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me. But that's like a fun little like, oh, okay, nobody got hurt into like the most depressing story.
Yeah, it's depressing because I think that there's something that they're leaving out here. It's about, it's called Looking for Angeline. And in 1941, it was right at the end of the Great Depression. I mean, sort of, right? I mean, the war is kind of going on. We have 12-year-old Barney Dewey. And this got me upset because I have a 12-year-old. So I'm just kind of comparing that whole situation. And he worked at a gas station that I think they just worked there. They don't own it or anything. And he watches after his little sister, Angeline, who plays in the dirt. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's Haskell, Texas.
I know, she's like throwing nuts into, like, what do you call, hubcap.
They're poor.
And she's just like, oh,
yeah,
boy.
I mean, they're super poor. Like a lot of people, I think, I'm not really sure. I didn't look into the background of Haskell, Texas, but I'm guessing at the time, just like the rest of the country, they were just super struggling. Their mother worked very long hours, and they had a stepfather, but he was hospitalized, at least at the time. I don't know if we ever get a real update as to what, whether he got better or something like that. Not sure how they paid for his hospitalization or any of that stuff.
I don't know.
You had a favorite quote that you had pulled out.
Yeah, poor little Barney just said, like, at that time, we were just concerned trying to keep body and soul together. Like, oh, I just love that. Just, they were just trying not to die, basically. But he said it so cute. He's, like, the most lovable guy we've ever seen on Unsolved Mysteries.
I don't know.
I went to
I thought
him.
That Reverend Nichols was really bringing it to the table.
Yeah. I freaking
if he had smiled, that. I would not have... I would have expected there to be fangs. Reverend Nichols, basically, if you're going to fully believe the story, okay, which I don't, he abducted these two children.
Yeah, but, okay, so he does it in a way that's like stranger danger to the max. So he has like all this candy and he's like, Barney and Angeline, come with me, you know, and he's giving a lot less.
You sound like the Count.
It's like, But it's like, run, kids. Oh, my God. And he's like, you want some candy? Oh, your mom said that you guys have to come with me. And they're like 12 and what? Probably 7. So they're like, okay, I guess we have to go with you. So he takes them and he's like, you can call me Daddy Nichols if you'd like. Ugh.
It makes you want to vomit. It does make you vomit.
Yeah. And he takes them and he like scrubs them up and he gives them new clothes and he gives them like a big old dinner, which they probably weren't super used to.
It didn't sit well to me when I heard he took them to a hotel.
I know. And like bathed them and took pictures of them.
You
know, I know.
Other pictures. You know, it's sicko.
I know.
But I feel personally that these kids were sold. I mean, we'll get to it. There's a lot to come.
Yeah. Ugh, I didn't think that until you said that, and I was like, wow, how could I be so naive? Because I think the mom does have more in it than she said, because he did know their names, and he was able to, like, trip them. But basically, he's taking pictures, and they're just smiling. These little angel-faced little kids are smiling, because they don't know that these pictures are basically, like, an ad for brother and sister who need adoption.
They look so cute in that. So, I mean, and they have the photos, which I just... Where the hell did that come from? I mean, I know that files were left over, but the fact that they have these photos in their possession is kind of crazy.
That is crazy. And we'll post that on the Facebook page, of course. But, like, the Reverend is like, oh, kids, something's wrong with your mom. So we're going to just, like, load you up on this bus. But don't worry, because you're going to see your mom. And the girl's like, no, no, Barney, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. And he's like, we have to. Like, we have to go see our mom. It's okay. This is Daddy Nichols. He wouldn't lie to us. He's been so nice to us. So they get up on the bus, and they are shipped off to Reverend Nichols, like, foster home, basically. It's like an orphanage. So they're there, and... One day, the Reverend comes with his adopted son, who's Nick Crane, and he's like, Barry, we're taking you home, or we're taking you to your new home. So Angeline goes to, like, go with them, and they're like, no, not you. We only want the boy. And so Angeline's crying, and this woman has to hold her back. And in the reenactment, she's like, Barney, you said we was going to see our mom again, and all this stuff. And he's just getting, like, carted off to this car. It is heartbreaking.
It's like, you just don't want to have to be this child for the next couple weeks, you know? I mean, I'm sure over time, you know, she forgot about it, what happened on some level, but... I couldn't imagine. Just when I was very little, I had abandonment type of issues where I felt I had anxiety, and when I was very little. So I kind of that came back when I started seeing her being like that, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And we later learned that she has some like mental.
What are you saying about me, Kim?
I'm not sure the right way to say it. I'm not. But I'm just saying, like, how much could she understand of what was happening at that time? Like, it's really, really hard. But they take Barney, right? And where do they send him? Sorry, I'm just hogging this.
No, no, it's fine. They go to Abilene, Texas, or Abilene, I'm sure. And he goes to work on kind of his own farm, right? He lives about 8 miles from the... From the people who had adopted them are the Reverend's secretary and her husband. We don't know if that's true. I mean, nothing has been true up to this point, right?
I guess not. Yeah. And like, he can't even live with
them. We also don't have a name for them or where they, you know,
no.
We just have this town. And I would love to know what the story was, how much they paid for these for him, because I feel like, honestly, they purchased a farmhand.
Oh, yeah.
This was,
oh,
this
definitely.
Is slavery right here. Room and board. That's it.
And he was saying, like, I kind of liked having, you know, my horse and, you know, they were nice enough and they gave me glasses and stuff because I couldn't see and all this stuff. And it's like, oh, my God, you precious little guy. Like, you have
12, 13 years old. We don't have a timeline, which kind of bothers me a little bit.
He was there for a year.
Was it a full year?
I do know that. He was there for a
year. Harry Potter
glasses. Or at least away from his mom for a year. Yeah. And he got his glasses. And, like, they said, he's like, I didn't want to be here anymore. Like, I miss my mama and my sister so bad. I didn't want to be here anymore. So I left my good clothes because they bought me those good clothes. And I didn't want to take them. So he puts on his little shabby clothes.
That somehow fits, though.
And he takes,
right? I mean, we're 12 to 13. You know, having a 12-year-old, I understand that his sneakers that we bought a week ago might not fit next week.
Yeah, which makes it even sadder because he was probably cramming his feet into there and stuff, you know? And he's like, I gotta go. And so he takes this little 37 cents that he has to his name, which is like about $6.50 nowadays money. And he takes it and he like starts hitchhiking from Abilene all the way back to Haskell, which is 100 miles away. And then when he gets there,
well, I just want to mention, you know, on Little House on the Prairie, Paul actually walked 100 miles for work. And so 100 miles, you know, it's a real distance. Unfortunately, Charles did not have the ability to just stick his thumb out there and get picked up. But thankfully, nothing bad happened that we know of between Abilene and Haskell. But he actually managed to get back there. When he got there, he found that his mother and stepfather had moved away. Now, let me just ask you. God forbid your dog ran away, okay?
Oh, my God.
Let's say your dog is, you know, 8 years old. Would you be able to just leave? Like, now...
No.
Now, a kid, you know, I mean, I wouldn't even... Just my dog. One of my dogs ran away, and I have no proof of what happened. I'm not going to move away.
And I know.
That's a dog. This is two children of theirs. So this is where it kind of clicked with me. And I'm thinking, one of the girls, you know, the girl seems to have some type of developmental issue. So why not, to be cold about it, let's get rid of her. And the boy will watch over her. And because this guy with the fangs is saying that he wouldn't separate them.
Yeah. I think you're right, honestly. You know? Didn't even cross my mind until you said that. And I was like, that has to be what happened.
So
it's the only thing that makes sense.
So he's getting off like a bus and his mother didn't even recognize him, which just made me even more so kind of think, like, what's wrong with you?
Well,
oh, I'm sorry.
He went to Haskell. His mom wasn't there.
I skipped the whole part.
So he goes, no, it's okay. So he goes to Cleburne, Texas. And this guy is like pinging all over the map. And we get like a map of his journeys, you know. He goes to Cleburne, meets his birth father. His birth father takes him all over Texas. Is like, I don't want this kid, trying to ship him back to his mom. Puts him on a bus to cross like east to west Texas on a bus, which must have taken like a week. And then he gets off the bus and the mom is like still looking. Like he's standing right in front of her. And she's like, when's he coming? And he's like, Mom, it's me. Like I'm standing right in front of you.
You know. So she clearly kept in contact with the father, who she doesn't even have a kid with.
Yeah, I know.
Anymore.
I thought that was weird. Yeah, because he knew where she was.
The whole thing was very strange. But apparently, maybe they split the money. I don't know. Like, I'm really going down a rabbit hole of conspiracies. But why else would two people who are divorced have any communication with each other if you're going to move? You know, I don't want to think about those kids. Let's find a new place. So.
I don't know. But he's like, Mama, did you ever sign papers to give me away? And she's like, no, you were stolen from me. Like, I never would have given you up.
Yeah. I just don't buy it. But so he ended up living with her until he was 18. I mean, he would live with her for another 5 or 6 years.
Like,
So, and then he got married. And when he was 22, he and his wife, Stella, he started turning into a pretty good kid, I think. You know, I really fell in love with him.
Oh, he's an angel. Honestly. Honestly, I love him
so
much.
He tracked down Nick Crane, who's the adopted son of the Reverend, who's maybe the only person he could kind of think of that really kind of made an impression. The only person he could track down, maybe. And Nick said that Reverend Nichols died 2 years earlier. I don't believe it. He probably is still alive, you know, drinking baby blood or something. And that, the orphanage was shut down by the state. Very convenient.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah. But there's some records, like, left behind this old pharmacy of mine right here. So if you want to have a look, like, go ahead. And there's just, like, a few tattered boxes. So they go through, and maybe that's where they got the picture from. I don't know. But they can't find any record on what happened for Angeline. And so we get Barney, who is, like, the most nice, upbeat, head-on-his-shoulders kind of guy talking about Unsolved Mysteries. And he's like, look, it's been half a century. And he's, like, tearing up. And he's like, I just want my sister.
Yeah, so... there is an update, and there's a very nice, happy story here. But one of the things that now resonates with a very different way, well, I'll mention it when we get to it. But so the update is that a man named Neil Smith said that Angeline was his adopted sister, Martha Jean, and she was in a group home. She has issues that just, you know, she needs a little bit of help, you know, and she lives in... Well, you know what? Do we mention the place? I don't know if we... okay.
Yeah, I think. Rainbow... Why not? She doesn't still live there. I don't think.
The Rainbow Acres Ranch, yeah. Which you've tracked it down. Seems like a pretty nice place.
It's amazing.
In Arizona. And yeah. They have horses, or at least they visited horses. And it looks like a nice place. And as somebody who...
Yeah.
I have a nephew who has autism, and he's really low functioning. Mm-hmm. And he actually lives in a group home because... of some type of physical things. I mean, the kid's like 6'2" now, and he's like 16, you know, and he can get a little bit physical. So, we visit him from time to, you know, as much as we can. And it's a really nice group of people. He's treated very, very well, and it's not cheap. And so when I looked at the website, I was like, you know, this looks like a really good place. Like, and, so, yeah, I mean, it just resonated in that sense where she's at the right place. Like, you know, they took care of her. They didn't just ship her off to the, you know, and just say, it's your problem.
I know.
It's somebody else's problem.
So Barney is like, I'm going to meet my sister for the first time in over 50 years. I'm so excited. Yeah. So on March 23rd of 1992, of course, Unsolved Mysteries cameras are there. Yeah. And she gets out of the car, and he is, like, the happiest thing you've ever seen. And he seems to work really well with her disabilities and stuff. Like, he's like, look at me. Can you look at me? Do you remember when we took that picture and when we got separated? And he's taking her, and he's, like, showing her pictures of their other siblings.
It didn't click with her at first, it seemed. And then it did, and it was like, you know, she really lit up a bit.
I know. And he starts tearing up at the end. This one, I started like having goosebumps, and he was like, I'm just so happy to know that during those 50 years, she was loved and she was cared for.
Now she said, my only regret is that my mother didn't get to see this reunion. I'm thinking your mother's probably a piece of crap. So I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I just don't think you move.
Oh yeah, sorry. Please. It was just so heart-wrenching. I agree that you don't move. Like, that's a big red flag whenever we have, like, child abduction cases or whatever, and the people move. Oh, my God, I can't even remember her name. But that little baby that we did, Sabrina Eisenberg.
Don't ask me to remember.
27 years after the day, actually, exactly, that they reunited. In 2019, Barney died, and he was, like, a pastor. He and his wife, Stella, were married 71 years until his
God bless
death.
Him.
And I know. And in that picture, we'll post on the Facebook page, it's, like, the last picture taken of him that is out there on the internet. And he's still just so smiling and happy. And he's got a big square head and glasses. He kind of looks like the old guy from Up. Like, he's so cute.
I just feel like if you were to go and try to attack his sister, he'd beat the crap out of you. Like, he's you know, in such a brotherly way. And I love it. I love this relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that they found each other. Seriously.
I am too. Oh my God. If any story ever deserved a happy ending, my God, that was it.
But this nine children.
Also a lost
nine
love.
Lives, you call it. Or you didn't call it. Ooh. They called it.
No, I didn't call it.
Nine. But, nine kids.
Yeah. This is an update from a previous story, which aired season 4, episode 13 originally. So we're going to kind of breeze past as
we cover this before?
Standalone updates.
All right, because I must have seen this episode or the other version of this, but because I remember the guy at the end. And
oh, right, with this juicy, juicy mullet. We get a lot of mullets in this episode. But on May 31st of 1974, we're in Toledo, Ohio, and funeral services are being held for 34-year-old Wanda Vess. She left behind 9 children at the age of 34 who are parentless.
I'm just thinking you spent 18 years pregnant, right?
No, 10.
I mean, holy moly. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's a lot. Don't get me wrong. It's a lot. You spent 8 years.
But if
years
she's
pregnant.
34 and she's a 16-year-old, she had a kid when she was 18?
16. 18.
So, but that's what I'm saying. It's kind of like... That's a lot of time to be pregnant. It's your whole life.
Yeah, her kids range from 16 to 10 months old. And so we learn that they're parentless because the reason she is in that coffin is because her husband and their dad shot her after an argument. He was a super abusive alcoholic and she was a housewife. And she was like, I'm getting a divorce. I don't want to do this anymore. So she got a job at this bar in Toledo called the Cameo Bar to support.
And you've said in the past, I just like to repeat it. This is usually the most dangerous times for a woman is when she's trying to separate her relationships or sever her relationships with someone or a man, rather.
Yep. 100% with an abusive partner. But so she's working at the Cameo Bar to support because she got 10 mouths to feed, including herself. And she is 2 weeks later, he shows up. It's her 34th birthday and he wants to reconcile. And she says no. They get into a fight at like 1 a.m. at this bar. And he goes to his truck, retrieves a shotgun, shot her, reloaded and shot her again. So he was arrested an hour later at another bar, just drinking like it ain't no thing. So he actually pled guilty to first degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison. And he only had to serve 9 of those years because he died in 1983. So after this funeral, this is the really messed up part. The grandparents can either keep the kids or get rid of the kids. And they're like, what we're going to do is we're going to keep one of the kids. We're going to send 4 of you off to foster care and we're going to adopt 4 of you.
Line up kids. We're going to draw straws, you know?
Yeah. And it's, why keep one? If you're going to, it's got to be all or nothing. And it was heartbreaking because the main girl, Shireen, says, like, I felt like we were punished for my dad's behaviors because nobody wanted to keep us because keeping us would be facing the fact that my dad shot my mom. And I think that was just too hard for the adults in my life to comprehend.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I would respond to all of that. When we first, when my sister-in-law had kids, she has 5 children. We spoke about this, like, God forbid something were to happen, we would take the kids. And I'm just like, it was my biggest nightmare. don't go on that plane, you know, but to take in 5 kids was so, I mean, it wasn't real anxiety, but it was like putting myself in that fan fiction. It's crazy.
Yeah.
9. And you're old, that's, you know, so at this point, you're really old, you know, your grandparents.
Teenagers, yeah, and they're teenagers and they're like angsty teenagers that are gonna have problems because their mom was just shot by their dad.
There's a lot
these are yeah, exactly. And I know this sounds awful, you know, we're all God's children, whatever, but I'm just saying, if you're like old, but then what you do is you get rid of all of them, you don't keep one. Like, that is,
it's
so
terrible. It's
up.
Like,
so,
it really is right there with Sophie's Choice. Like, it's, you can't do it to one.
Yeah,
it's like, you just, it's a terrible decision to have to make.
Yeah. And so Shireen was put into foster care. She was the 16-year-old out of this whole thing. And she was in foster care for 3 months before she ran away and just began living life on the streets.
Good for her in
a
lot of ways, because 16, you just went through this terrible time. Get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. I can't imagine the strength that you have to have. But in 1986, she starts searching for her siblings. And within 2 years, she's able to find 8 of the 9 kids. Yeah. So we're missing one. We're missing Heath. He was 6 when everybody was separated.
It's
when
before
the
internet, too. So it had to be tough.
Yeah. in order to, I mean, to find most of them, that was pretty crazy. But on the night of the broadcast, Heath calls the telecenter. And so within 4 weeks, Heath and his wife, Robin.
I love this. I love the name Heath. I don't know. Some. I don't know. Oh,
reminds me of the bar. Yeah. But they arrive in Los Angeles and five of his siblings are there. And of course, Unsolved Mysteries cameras are there. So everybody, this is where we get a lot of the mullets, and everybody's just like hugging and crying and laughing, showing pictures.
I really loved it. Happy reunion. You know, it's weird. He's a goofball, I think. And there's a bit of a machoism there, but he turns into a big softy pretty quickly. He's not like just grabbing people and hugging them because he doesn't know these people, you know? But he knows that he's related to them. He's starting to feel the family. I think we even see that on camera. It's like a really kind of a magical moment where he just takes their hand and they embrace, you know, and it's just really sweet. But his hair does get in the way of the emotions.
Yeah, but it was so sweet, though, because like at the end, he just says, like, my whole life, I have never felt wanted until today. And these people just like embraced me. And oh, my God, it was such a missing piece of my life this whole time.
He said, I have that wanted feeling now. And it's like, wow, that's good for you, man.
It's profound and it's really deep and it's very vulnerable for a man to be putting out there on national television, you know, especially like a macho kind of guy. I was surprised and it just like, I just wanted to hug him.
There's this video game guy, I think he's called Mr. Wonderful or something like that. And he really reminds me of him and he's like a total turd. But I mean, I'll dig it up and I'll post a link to the photo of Mr. Wonderful. Two, he reminded me of physically, but he just seemed like a really sweet guy.
Yeah, and then, you know, we get, like, our warm and fuzzies out of the way because we're going right back down. We're getting depressed again.
You mean heading down to Tennessee? Or for you, up to Tennessee?
Yeah, exactly. Lewis Chapel, Tennessee, and we are in the mountains, people. Like, this is rural as it gets.
Yeah, we have Joe and Maddie who are in their mid-50s, and they run Harvey's Garage.
I know. And it's like one of these cute places in the middle of these small towns where it's like you can't make it to the big city. So this is like a joint convenience store / auto body repair shop. And like, trust me, I get it. Like my nearest store is like 20 miles away from me. And that's like a little gas station that has.
Yeah, it's like Olson's Mercantile in the middle of nowhere. Where else are you going to go? You're going to go to Mankato? Go to Mankato.
Exactly. Yeah, and try complaining about these prices because we're all you got, buddy. So it's the only place that they can get stuff. And apparently it's like the local watering hole. It's just where everybody hangs out. And can't you see it?
Oh, totally. This is like where you get your Coke. Well, not literally cocaine. I mean, like you buy your bottle of Coke and you drink it with your pals in the front.
Yeah, exactly. And you wonder how, you know, Sharon's doing after her baby.
It's like Twilight Zone, actually. Gossip. That's what it feels like. It's the town where they stop in the Twilight Zone. And it's amazing. It's small town America, and it's exactly what you would expect it to probably look like. Well, I did a quick real estate thing, and I did find a really nice house for about $400,000. Oh, it's a really, really nice area, and there's a lot of property available. So,
oh, yes. Gorgeous. So... but yeah, so Joe's brother, Joe, our main guy here, he says that they used to keep a lot of cash around because they didn't even have a bank account.
Yeah, you don't own a business without a bank account. I mean, and I was saying...
But you know what I was thinking? This is like backwoods Tennessee. And I'm from Hicksville. Like, I feel like I can say this. This is backwoods Tennessee. These people are of the age that their parents got hit hard during the Great Depression. And I'm sure they didn't trust banks. They grew up being told don't trust banks.
Yeah, you know, like my grandparents grew up in the Great Depression, but they kind of got over it. You know, it was one of those things. Yeah. Not they got over it. You know,
I know.
I don't know. It's just not a smart thing. The first mistake I wrote here is to actually have a large amount of cash. Now, we're not talking about $500. We're not talking about even $10,000. We're talking six figures. So...
Yeah, $150,000.
Yeah, and letting anyone know that this money exists, it's insane. But these people, they didn't have children. So the people of the community were their family.
I know, but it's really interesting, though, because the brother was like, if you're not going to get a bank account, you at least need to get a gun because somebody is going to come for this money. So... Because they're like older and they never had kids, they really, really bonded with Maddie's niece, who is Cheryl. And she is 27 years old. She actually has a 5-year-old daughter herself. And apparently, Maddie treated Cheryl like she was her own daughter.
They were in love.
They were close.
They were real fat.
Yeah, and they even lived next to each other at certain points in time. So they were very, very close with each other. And all of a sudden, Monday rolls around March 4th, 1991. And people are lining up outside of Harvey's garage. And it's not open for like the first time in history. It's not open when it's supposed to be. So they call Sheriff Joe May. And Joe May goes, and he needs to do a wellness check on these people. You know, they are kind of older. They look
I'm
older.
10 years away from the oldest one.
I know.
But the reenactors are in their like late 60s and 70s, so.
Yeah, they looked really old. So he like, Sheriff Joe May's like, you know, Teet, because they call Maddie Teet for some reason.
I like it, though. They call, makes me uncomfortable.
It depends on who gave her the nickname. So they're like, Teet, Joe, like, where are y'all at? And they can't find him. So the door's open. So Sheriff Joe May pushes the door and he sees that the inside is, he calls it gutted, but I think he just means it's pretty burned
really
up.
Burned up. We get to see actual footage, you pointed out. You know, it's weird. And it wasn't until the second viewing that I noticed it was actual footage.
Yeah, this is not common for unsolved mysteries that we get like the actual police search
and they're like
footage.
They discovered a gas can. You know, and there it is. There's the gas can and untouched. It's not even the gas can is not didn't even get hot enough to peel the paint. You know,
I know. Yeah, it's sitting there perfectly preserved. Everything's like real sooty around it. But it's sitting there. So we see the sheriff like backing it up and they're going through. And the sheriff says once he saw the house gutted, he goes down the stairs, the porch stairs, and he finds little bits of blood, hair, and flesh on the stairs.
Not to judge. So he calls in, not to judge them, but they really, really lived below their means. They were not.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that they weren't comfortable and they weren't living exactly the way they wanted to live, but. If they have this business and they have this accumulation of funds, why are they living in this? You know, they could buy the big screen TV. Maybe they did have the big screen TV, but it just felt to me like spend your money a little bit.
I mean, look, A, you can't take it with you. I totally understand that. But B, Jack calls it like rich people camouflage because you don't want to be the target. You don't want people to come in and rob you. Maybe you're just like, hey, look, we're just like
did
you
I
guys.
Lose you?
So I don't know. No, nope,
oh,
are you here?
You said you quoted Jack, and then it went silent.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, he's a man of few words. But no, he calls it rich people camouflage because why look all flashy and stuff and draw a bigger target on yourself?
I guess. I don't know. What are you waiting? You can't take it with you, Cam.
I know that.
That's what I tell my wife all the time when I want to buy something.
Charge it. But he calls in agents from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and they find a 2-gallon can of gas on the table like we talked about, and they find a ton of blood spots throughout the house. So the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, Tennessee, believes that this is arson that is set to cover up the crime scene.
Yeah, and it looked like there was a really big fire. Like they poured the gasoline, lit it, and left. And then the fire went out. Mm-hmm. It looked like it was a roaring fire, too, by the looks of the walls. But I took a little quick screenshot. You could see where maybe they had a photo hanging. And the heat probably singed it to the point where maybe it had a little string in the back or something. And the heat burned it away. But by the time that was exposed, the fire was already out. So you could see it's not even burned. Behind where a picture was.
Yeah.
So it was probably like a flash and then it just went out. Maybe their house was very well insulated and it just ran out of oxygen very quickly, which is a little scary.
I think that's probably
open a window.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I understand. I think, I mean, if you're trying to commit arson, you'd want some good oxygen flow in there, but thank God that it wasn't, because when they turn over the gas can, they find intact, a bloody fingerprint on the bottom of the gas can. Now, during this time, okay, they're like, it's probably a robbery because of all the cash that they kept on hand. They didn't find any cash at the house. So during this time, niece Cheryl, like, goes off the beaten path. She's disappeared. And people in this town are like, oh, my God, three people from the same family are disappeared. Like, and we don't know what happened to them. Because at this point, we still don't know what happened to Joe and
Maddie. These are people who are loved in the community from what we can tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually, less than a week after they disappear, Cheryl, the little niece, her truck is found abandoned at a truck stop 2 hours away from home. It was unlocked with keys in it. Her necklace was laying beside it, and her purse was in the truck. Her
5-year-old daughter is missing.
Yeah, exactly. At this and her 6-week-old son, you know, at this point, yes. But TBI agents question Cheryl's baby daddy, who is 30-year-old Eddie Wooten.
No, TBI. No. I just wanted to ask you about this. TBI is the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Do you have an F?
Yes.
Like, well, is Florida Bureau of Investigation, like the FBI? You know, like.
I'm sure.
Well, I mean, what do you call it down there? But I'm just kind of curious. Like,
they call it like the
I wonder
SBI
if every state
sometimes.
Or county has a Bureau of Investigation. I mean, I always thought it was just detectives and type of crime scene detectives. But I'm just.
Yeah, it's like the next one up. I know a lot of times they call it the State Bureau of Investigation, so the SBI, but it's. I feel like they come in when, like, our little guys can't handle
it. I just
it.
Never saw it being called something like TBI, you know?
Oh, yeah, I think Paul Renfro. I keep saying he's fan favorite, but let's be real, he's my favorite. Paul Renfro, I think he worked for the OBI, like the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. So I've seen it a few
times. Thank
them
for their courage.
Oh, yeah, thank you,
the BIs.
Fine ladies and gentlemen. But so when they question Eddie Wooten, the baby daddy, he says that he took Cheryl, the niece, to Newport News, Virginia. And they're like, where? And he's like, I don't really remember.
Yeah, this, even the reenactor was kind of awesome like this. He's like, I don't know why.
Yeah, and so the whole, like, unsolved mysteries of it all is like, was Cheryl taken by the same people who took, you know, the Harveys, the, you know, our little Joe and T, or is she in on it? So on March 10th, which is like a week after they do the wellness check, Eddie Wooten is questioned again. He tells police that in late February, which keep in mind was just like a few weeks before, he took Cheryl to a hospital for stomach cancer, but he can't remember the
name
of
the
hospital.
One. How many can there be?
Exactly, that big one. No, not that one. But they, like, supposedly Cheryl had been borrowing money from friends and family left, right, and freaking center to get money for this cancer treatment. And it turns out it was all a big crock because she never had cancer. And it was just a scam to try and get money off of
it's just it's a terrible scam. And it was probably just targeting this couple. Because, maybe that's how she learned that they had money, you know, or learned it and they said, well, you know what, I need $800, you know.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, I've seen it rumored places that she was, like, nursing a little drug habit, so allegedly, but this all kind of makes sense when you put it under that
umbrella. The reenactor of Eddie, I liked him a lot. I thought that, I like when he pulls out a cigarette and goes to smoke in the interrogation.
Oh, yeah, when they show the reenactment, he is unblinking, and it is truly scary. Like, but he gave it his all. So it's like a month and a week later, and they bring good old Eddie Wooten in again. And they're like, Eddie, it's time for you to confess what you know. And so he's like, all right.
He's like, what's going to happen if I tell you what happened?
And they're like, oh, you know, don't worry about it. Why don't you just tell us what's going
to
happen first?
Yeah, according to him, he didn't really want to do it. But Cheryl was, bullying him into doing it. But by saying that, he was doing it.
And, you know, this is all his point of view. So, of course, he's going to try and lessen his involvement.
Doesn't matter if he didn't want to do it.
Yeah, exactly. You did it. So, Cheryl, according to his confession, this is all according to him. Cheryl was working and Eddie wasn't. He was kind of being a bum. And she was like, we need more money. So, on March 2nd of 1991, this is 2 days before the wellness check, they load their kids, 5-year-old that Cheryl had from a previous relationship, and a 6-week-old baby, and they go up to the Harveys' house with a gas can. And he's like, I didn't want to do it, but she was like, come on, Eddie, you gotta do it.
I don't buy his story at all. This was discussed over a 12-pack of cheap beer first.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So they walk in the house and Joe, little old adorable Joe, is sleeping in front of the TV and they're like, Joe, wake up. And he's like, oh, hey, how y'all doing? Yeah. Boom. Eddie shoots him right on the spot. And then Maddie comes running out like, what was that sound? Boom. He shoots Maddie
in cold
right
blood.
In the head.
When
they
did the reenactment of him shooting them, I was just like, wow, this is that part is probably very accurate. He probably went in there, boom, and then she came running and boom.
I know. It was really sad. So then Eddie goes out to the car. He says Cheryl told him to do this. He tells the five-year-old, we're going to play a game. Lay down on the floor. You know, we just want you to lay down on the floor so that she couldn't see them loading the dead bodies of the Harveys into the Harveys'
own car. Don't look
or
we'll have to kill you. So,
yeah, exactly. We're going to play peekaboo. Just like hide down there, count to 1,000. So they put the bodies in the trunk of the Harvey's car. So Cheryl, then the niece, drives the car. Eddie trails with his like 6-week-old and the 5-year-old kid in the back. They drive across the Alabama border and they go to this like Bridgeport ferry on the Tennessee River and just drive the car with the bodies in it straight into the river. So according to Eddie, Cheryl returned alone to the Harvey house and she stole $150,000 in cash, poured the gas on the ground and torched the place. So 2 days later, Cheryl shows up because they have it all like cordoned off like crime scene. And she's like, oh no, what happened to them? You know? And then supposedly, according to the reenactment, she hears that they find the gas can with the fingerprint on it. And she's like, I gotta get out
right.
of
and she's
Dodge.
Like, a new Walkman. No, I'm just like a Benetton outfit. I'm thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And then Anna Holland. Oh, no, it was juicy. Those glasses were straight 1991. So we get to meet her sister, and her sister is like, Cheryl did not do this. She is innocent until proven guilty. And I think Eddie did it. And I think Eddie killed her. And that's why we can't find Cheryl. So we do know a few things. On April 17th of 1991, searchers dragged the Tennessee River and they find the Harvey's car. And sure enough, Joe and Maddie's bodies are found in the back and they're shot in the head.
I mean, and this is a 3-hour distance, right? I mean,
yeah,
that has to be well over maybe 100 miles. Does it matter that it's 100 miles away? It's just the whole thing is very strange to me.
I mean, doesn't this scream like meth head behavior to you?
The whole thing, it's all like knee-jerk behavior.
Yeah, exactly. What really broke my heart was Sheriff Joe May talking about finding the bodies because he was friends with Joe and T. And he was like, I had to look at them and I was so used to seeing them smiling in the general store. And then I had to see their bodies, you know, waterlogged for a month and a half. And I had to see them in that condition. And you could tell he was still shell-shocked. Yeah.
That was a really honest, you know, it was a very honest and very, I guess, revealing moment for him. Because, I mean, this is somebody who's probably seen some bad stuff. And to see that, which is just two people who everybody seemed to like, minus these two people, it's just crazy. I hope that we never have to do anything like that.
Oh my God, seriously. But we do, you know, Eddie is arraigned on first degree murder because his story matches up. And so he gets charged and we get a warrant issued for Cheryl's arrest. So police track her movement. Thank God we find the kids. The 6-week-old and the 5-year-old are left with her mother. So they're okay. So we can stop worrying about that. But on March 7th, so 5 days after the murder, Cheryl is seen by a service station employee in Greenville, Tennessee, which is the 3-hour drive from Lewis Chapel. And she is like going to go pay for gas when all of a sudden this guy is like comes screeching in and he's like a big mean dude with a leather jacket and a beard. And she's like, I gotta go. And so as soon as she peels out, that guy starts chasing her, starts like kind of giving chase. And the service station attendant says that she sees this. So she leaves and she is later seen getting into his truck at like 11:30. And we learned later that the day before this whole murder plot went down, that she was seen at her work writing that guy a check.
Unbelievable. But what about the check?
Yeah, so
the check?
I don't know where the check is, but I think this whole thing is BS to like create a diversion because it's so like, oh my God, he's following me. And you're just, I think this whole thing was orchestrated to create, to make you think that she died.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I didn't think about that.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think he was probably hired and that they went everywhere they could to be seen together and to look scared of him and stuff like that. So we are like suspicious of the guy in the pickup truck, but Bill Pope, who is like this really genuine, down-to-earth district attorney general tells us that this is all, like, speculation. We don't know for sure what's going on, but keep an eye out for
this. You know, this is where the story just kind of got really a little bit confusing to me, and it just seemed, I don't know, to kind of lose focus a little bit.
And, you know, this is a two-parter. So originally this aired in two different parts and they kind of jammed mm-hmm. them together in the re-edit to put them on Amazon or iTunes
Maybe
or
that's
whatever.
It. Maybe and so that's I, what screwed me up.
Yeah. I think they were trying to stretch out two bits of it when they're really.
This is like a 20-minute segment.
Yeah, this is like almost half of the episode. So we do get an update. 45 minutes after the broadcast, Cheryl Holland was captured almost 1,000 miles away near Austin, Texas, thanks to a viewer tip who was actually the Shaw Padani guy who they interview. he is like her employer at like a mobile gas station. And he's like, that's you, you silly girl. And she's like, I'm sorry. Like, I've done some things in my life. So they call the cops. The cops show up and are like, are you Cheryl Holland? She's like, yep, sure enough, I am. So they arrest her. She was going under the fake name of Amy Forrester.
Yeah, like that. Her driver's license looks awesome. It's like, yeah. It's like, she probably spent about $400 on that.
Yeah, and it's not even that great of a fake ID, but she was extradited back 4 days later to Tennessee to face charges of first-degree murder. So Eddie and Cheryl actually both end up taking plea deals to take the death penalty off the table. So they are convicted on two first-degree murder sentences each, and they each receive life sentences. So Eddie was first eligible for parole, because keep in mind, this happened in 91. He's eligible for parole April 2020, and Cheryl is first eligible for parole November of 2021, so in like a year.
Jeez.
Eddie didn't get paroled this time, though, but he is eligible again in February of 2021.
That's in 4 months.
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. But, you know, he didn't get it the last time. Maybe he won't get it again, but I do have their most recent mugshots, which I'll post on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast.
Holy
on
cow,
Facebook.
That was taken... Is that 2013, I think? So 7 years ago, 3 days ago.
Yeah, no, it says 2019.
So it was almost exactly a year ago. Is she smiling or grinning?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
That freaks me out every time I see it.
He still looks, like, upset, which you should. You're in jail for the rest of your life, not to mention you murdered these two old people. I mean, you can't cry every day. I understand this, but, like, you're still in jail. Like, it's not a
He's
fun place
short.
To be.
I mean... Or is she really tall?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like she's only like maybe an inch or two shorter, but.
Yeah. Right. You're right. I don't know. But, you know, she's got kind of boofy hair.
Yeah, I just, I don't know. The whole thing just kind of freaks me out when I see people grinning or smiling. And what I also find weird is their prisoner numbers are kind of close. I mean, didn't they get arrested at very different times?
Yeah, they got arrested several years apart, but, you know, I'm guessing she probably has her own, like, female prison number, and he has his own male one, because they are pretty
darn close.
Yeah,
it's like 300 apart.
You
know, maybe it's just kismet. Maybe they're meant to be together. Aww.
True love. But, no, I will tell you also who smiling mugshots don't look great for, and that is the parole board,
yeah.
I'm assuming. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed that she stays in there and has some time to think about what she's done. But that baby, by the way, is like 30
her nails
nowadays.
Are dark, by the way. It looks like.
You know, what else are you going to do?
I guess is what you have that one person who's like, I'll do your nails. I've seen Orange is New Black, you know.
I know. I'll do your nails. Just give me some Cheetos.
Except they're wearing blue jumpsuits. So. But, you know, I'm just, and yeah, it's a very sad story. It's really messed up. And it was one of those things where I have a feeling that if they had approached these people and they're like, look, can I have $10,000? Fine. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what, just rob them and leave, you know, and it would have been the same outcome.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it would have been a much lesser outcome, even if they were caught.
Yeah, but you just don't think you're going to be, you know? And they're like, well, if I leave them alive, then they definitely know mm-hmm. who I am and they can say. So it's just messed up because these people did seem to really love her and her family. And she just completely spit
all
in their faces.
All that delicious meth.
Let this be, I guess so. But let this be a lesson to all my nieces and nephews as I am childless. I don't have any money. Don't come barking around.
And by the way, I'm watching you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Like, as soon as like one of them walks in and like nobody else is around, you just pick up the phone. Hello, 911. Just can
thank God.
I'm gonna call back in 45 minutes, and if I don't call, just kind of swing by, okay?
Totally.
But as always, Kim, thank you so much for getting together for this wonderful episode. This was a lot of fun. It's a big.
Yeah, this was a fun one. Oh my God, the pleasure's all mine. Of course, I love doing this podcast. So thanks for being here.
Check us out on Facebook, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. And just kind of follow us. Lots of updates, lots of pretty good and amazing changes coming. So, you know, stay tuned.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.